Moncrief on News Talk.
Sponsored by Avant Card, offering Ireland's first personalised lending rates.
Yeah, Mairead Larry from the Farmers Journal joins us once again. Afternoon, Mairead.
Good afternoon. Yes, isn't Brexit? It will be interesting. I don't know. Has she had her cabinet meeting yet?
Well, she's having it right now.
And there's nobody walking out in high dungeon.
As far as we know, we haven't heard. No one's running out there and setting themselves on fire and like that. But not yet. But, you know, we don't know.
So this is really about the EU takes back control, isn't it?
Is it? I honestly think no one knows what's going to happen next.
Yeah,
really. Well, and that's by some miracle, and I'd say it is a miracle, she manages to convince her cabinet to all support her on this.
Well, then she still has to get through the Houses of Parliament.
Yes.
And really and truly, unless some of the Labour Party come in behind her, it's difficult.
Yeah.
I mean, she's got her own Tories. If every one of them toed a line, the Ulster Unionists say they're not going to do it. So,
yeah,
I mean, well, that's needed for the overall majority.
But if, say, she got the cabinet to back her. And some of the hardline Brexiteers in that would be able to influence some MPs to back her as well.
Yeah.
And so if she got a respectable amount of Tories and... Now, it depends what Labour's going to do. I mean, are Labour just going to by instinct vote again? Or is Jeremy Corbyn going to tell them to do that?
You just don't know what Jeremy Corbyn is telling.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there's two strands. Keith Stammer, who's the deputy or the head of the Brexit thing, or the shadow spokesman on it. I mean, he's clearly said he's looking for a second vote. You know, Gordon Brown, former Prime Minister.
Well, their position is they want a general election first, and then a retail. But if they're whipped to vote against it, some Labour MPs will break that whip. So
probably, yeah.
It's blinking chaos. Yeah,
oh no, but it's just look at it. I mean, if it was a word that I wish was never invented.
Yeah,
I spent last week or last Thursday up in Monaghan and across in Armagh, and just looking at some of the border crossings. And there was one there now, just outside the village of Mullen. And Mullen was a Mullen Mills. It was famous for the boots. It used to have a boot factory there.
Hmm.
Boot factory closed down, I suppose, after the war. And then the road was barricaded. So the village was at an absolute dead end. You know, it could only go back towards Emmyvale. And now it's been totally, all the old houses that were there, part of the mills, have been all renovated. There's a whole lot of new houses after being built in the place. It's a gorgeous little village. And to think that it could be, you know, barricaded back into a cul-de-sac again, you know, isn't really worth thinking about.
Yeah.
But I mean, the food industry between the north and the south. Now, there's a big, you know, food industry east-west as well, as we well know, particularly in the south. And, you know, some of the more churlish, British politicians and commentators have basically been saying, you know, we'll screw your food industry, you know, if Leo Varadkar continues to take a hard line on the backstop. And but there's a big trade back and forth. And, you know, that whole kind of ease of life now, you know, I'm old enough, unfortunately, to remember... you know, guys with, you know, machine guns peering out the ditches at you every time you wanted to go north of the border.
Yeah.
And the long, long delays and everything. And to just seamlessly drive through those borders now. And the only way you know is the fact that you've got yellow lines instead of white lines, or some of the lines are yellow. That's the only way you know. It's just, for anyone who's lived through the two varieties of that or the two versions of it, I think it's something that's so worth fighting for. And holding on for.
Not least of which the fact that we are dependent for so much of our trade into the UK.
Into the UK,
But the effects of that are incalculable.
But to dance this, you know, I enjoy Strictly, but the complications of the dance that has been going on with the Irish government over the past 2 years, trying to keep the EU 27 on board and all backing Ireland rather than having them hived off, which is what the Brits tried to do or attempted to do or thought that they definitely would be able to do. And they discovered, no, the collegiality was there. But holding the relationship with the UK, not permanently damaging that, and trying to hold a relationship in Northern Ireland as well. So to try and achieve all the things, plus the Irish agenda, not been simple, I wouldn't think.
The whole peace process, one thing I always remember from the peace process was this phrase, constructive ambiguity, and the ability to look in two directions at one time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is going to clear away the fog. It's created
500 pages of it. But yeah, there's 500 pages. There's a lot of fog in 500 pages.
Hopefully.
I don't care what anyone says. But look, it's just hopefully, you know, we're getting near D-Day at the end of it. And
well, let's hope so. Yeah. Well, yeah. Speaking of fog, wet rain anyway, the rain seems to be coming back. That must be a good thing.
Well, look, we've just had, particularly, you know, okay, the south and the southeast had a really terrible summer in the absolute alternative way that you could have a terrible summer in Ireland. It was really, really dry.
Yes.
And it imposed huge costs on farming, and particularly dairy farming, but right across the board, tillage, the whole lot of it, potatoes, everything, which I'll be talking about. But in other parts of the country, it was been a glorious year. It's just been perfect. Mm. There's fields that have been got into that haven't been got into for years, and work being done. And so, you know, we knew we were some awful 10 million bales of fodder short at the kind of early August. The hope was that we would get a really fine, mild winter. And if we had ordered it on a plate from heaven, we couldn't have got the weather. We couldn't have got more perfect weather for the last couple of months.
Okay, great.
Grass, the temperatures have stayed high. The ground has stayed in good condition because it hasn't. It's rained enough, but not too much. So the grass has been pushed on. Livestock are out. We've dairy farmers on both sides of us at home, and the cows were still out last weekend. Now, this time last year, they were in at the end of August. So, I mean, you had guests for dinner, you know, August, September, October, November, and they were still indoors having to be fed, whereas now they were out eating the grass that just grows naturally. So from that point of view, it's just been great, and people have got loads of fodder made. Now, okay, it's breaking. You know, it's colder weather is coming in. Like, it's 17 degrees out there today.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. Yeah.
You know, it only needs about 8 degrees or 10 degrees to grow grass well. Mm. So the grass is still growing. And the only thing that's stopping it now is the light. You know, we've got very short daylight hours. But all we now need is to get us through is we're now facing the middle of November. We just got half of November, December, January. And if the grass was growing again by February and livestock was able to be put out on grass, we would have squeaked out of the year with, okay, serious financial damage done to some farmers.
Mm.
But for a lot of the country, we would have squeaked through the year and, you know, got an awful lot better weather on, you know, than we would have expected or, you know, planned for earlier in the year. And it's like, it's always like, you know, this old saying, if your head's in the fire and your feet's in the fridge or the freezer, on average, you're all right.
Yeah.
Well, that's what we had with the weather. I mean, it was really bad in this time last year. It was bad in the springtime. Then it dried up. Everybody was delighted. And then it stayed dry. And a lot of people weren't delighted, but a lot of others were. And then we've got the great, great couple of months now. So it's just, isn't it? It's extraordinary how dependent we are on that weather.
Yeah.
Now, you only have to look at what's happening over in Malibu in California.
Oh, God,
to see what weather can do and, you know, the damage that it can wreak. But one of the areas that has been hit significantly now, because they're all being harvested now, are the potatoes, the potato crop. And potatoes need an awful lot of water. They need a lot of moisture. And where the crops were irrigated, and you don't think you should be irrigating in Ireland, good God. But anyway, where they were irrigated, they're seemingly coming out okay. But where they weren't, and there wasn't a facility to do that, you're talking about small potatoes, you're talking about misshapen potatoes, and you know how fussy some of our retailers are about the shape of stuff, even though it's perfectly edible. And you're talking about significant decline in the tonnage. Now, Stephen Robb, who looks after this sort of stuff, all to do with, you know, tillage, in the journal, he was telling me that back in 2012, we had a bad year and prices of potatoes went up because, you know, there wasn't as many coming onto the shelves and the customers were looking for them. But there was a real strong price elasticity in that when it reached a certain level, consumers went off and bought their carbohydrates in the shape of rice or in the shape of pasta. So putting up the price, you know, the first thing you'd ask is if there's going to be a shortage of potatoes or they're going to be scarcer than they were, who's going to carry the cost of it?
Yeah.
So, I mean, the thing here is that going to be farmers entirely? The consumer has showed that if you put up the price, they won't buy the potatoes And for the last 4 or 5 years, there's been a big effort to get them to go back to the levels of eating potatoes as they were prior to 2012-13. So putting up the prices may not be the answer. And, you know, the question you'd ask, are the retailers going to reduce their margin somewhat to be able to take some of the hit that's there? Because
I think we know the answer to that one.
Well, then you end up with maybe the processors and particularly the farmers paying for it. Already we're down about 1,000 hectares of potato crops. There's that much less sown in the country than there was back in 2012.
Mm.
We're also facing the problem that the UK was hit by the drought as well, and so were the potato growing regions in across Europe where we might import from. So we don't have a natural place to go off and take them, you know, just transfer them or send them over to Ireland. So just keep an eye on the potato situation, particularly as we go into the new year. There'll be plenty around at the moment, but as we hit into the new year, supplies are expected to get shorter.
Yeah. Are there changes coming in marts, as I understand
Yeah,
it?
Look, we all know farmers are getting older. If you go to a mart now, you're looking out at a lot of grey heads.
Mm.
And whether they like it or not, when you're 65 or 70, you're not moving as fast as when you were 30. And if have you ever been in a mart?
Well, you know
when the cattle come down, somebody's let out a lorry load of cattle and 15 big charging bullocks run down a line of pens, roaring their heads off, and, you know, you need to get out of the way fast.
Yeah.
So up to now, people were allowed to walk those walkways between the pens, even as the cattle were being sent in, you know, to be penned up for sale. And there's been several serious accident claims. There's been one fatality in the last 12 months as well.
Gini.
In the marts.
Yeah.
So what they're doing now is they're putting this lockdown, you know, it sounds like very much, you know, DEFCON 5, we're at lockdown. But the lockdown is there's nobody going to be allowed in between the pens and the lairage. Now, it's like breaking a 70-year habit with people, and it's been resisted. But it's for safety, and that's the reason they're doing it. Now, what they're going to do is, in some marts now, they have these walkways, skywalks.
Mm.
So you can walk above the cattle and you can look down and have a check on them. But there's these fellas going around who love to have, you know, put their hand on the flesh.
You do,
and
yes.
See what it's
you can
like.
See why.
Yeah. And comparing their own versus their neighbours and the rest of it. So what the marts are talking about doing is having a period of maybe a half an hour when all the animals are loaded up, but you've got the chance to go down. But they're just... there's a complete resistance now to having people walk around the place and cattle coming through and, you know, get out of the way fast and not able to do it and people being injured. And anyway, the insurance sector won't put up with it for too much longer either.
Yeah.
So that's the other thing.
Sugar beet factories. People
sugar
of a certain
beet.
Age again
yes,
will,
go on,
will,
tell me.
Will
where
remember.
Were the four sugar
well,
bags?
No, I actually, because I remember the one in Tuam, I suppose only because I was fairly close.
Right, where was the next one?
Oh, God, I don't know.
You don't? Did you not learn your geography?
No, well, I didn't pay much attention. I was staring out
there
the window.
There was Tuam and Thurles and Carlow and Mallow.
Right.
And they were set up in the 1930s, I think, as part of this kind of, you know, self-reliance, self-sustaining. And anyway, Tuam and Thurles, I don't know when exactly they were closed, but certainly sometime 20 years ago, 25, 30 years ago even. But Carlow and Mallow continued. And then I can't remember the details behind what happened. But one of them ended up closing. And then there was a deal brought in Europe to close down beet factories. And every country had to drop one. And we'd only one left. So we ended up having no sugar. So when you see grown no, you know, sugar in this country, or not, well, we still probably grow a bit of beet, but we're not turning it into sugar. And so, you know, when you see the Sucre brand, I mean, that's not one drop of it made in this country. It's all coming in from abroad. But there's been a group of people, farmers and different people, interests, and they have been pushing for to reinvigorate the whole sector. They're called Beet Ireland, and they've been at it for a couple of years. And they've gone now so far as to buy a site out in County Kildare in Castledermot to build a beet processing unit. And what they're looking for is they want farmers to stop belly aching now and complaining about this and giving out about the lack of a sugar industry in the country. If you're interested, now is your chance. They're looking for 1,000 farmers to put up €1,000 each, to put up a fighting fund of €1 million to pay for planning and licenses and all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also looking for them to commit to growing. They're talking about the place being able to process 1.4 million tonnes of beet annually. So that would mean around 45 to 50 acres each for to process or to grow that much beet.
Mm.
So they're looking for the commitment on the money front first to get everybody in as a, at a cooperative level, 1,000 each, everybody equal, and then for people to commit to growing a minimum of between 45 and 50 acres. And then it would depend on the tonnage. And that would support a processing plant. Now, you're still talking about an awful lot of money that's going to have to be raised and a big project. But they're looking for this by the end of the month or the end by Christmas, I think, really. And, you know, it's you know, it would be putting back an industry that
yes,
we had for so long.
Yeah.
That these people are passionate about, because they say, you know, there's a lot more you can do with beet than make sugar out of it. The ethanol's from it. The, you know, there's other, you know, science is bringing anything that has natural power attached to it.
Yeah,
science
yeah.
is able to deal with it now in a way that it couldn't 20 or 30 years ago. And, you know, we were doing very, very basic things. So, you know, people, Michael Hoey is one of them in Beet Ireland. And if you contact the members of the committee there, you know, if anyone is interested, the call is out. And, you know, it's in the hands of the farmers now. If 1,000 of them plus come forward, if they come forward with the €1,000, if they come forward with the offer to grow the product, this project can go ahead. But if they don't, Beet Ireland say, we'll use the site for something else and we won't be talking about this again.
OK, Mako texted in to say, so the beat goes on. Boom, boom. I'm Ray Lowry from the Farmers Journal there. We'll take a break back in a couple of minutes.
Moncrief on News Talk.
Sponsored by Avant Card, offering Ireland's first personalised lending rates.